You really confounded people like myself, because first novels are supposed to be very thin, usually made up of short stories used as a master's thesis in a creative writing program.
Right.
But you confounded everybody by turning it. How many pages is it?
735.
That is a very ambitious project, obviously. Let me, before we talk about Confessions of a Taoist on Wall Street, let me ask a couple of questions about yourself. Where were you born?
I was born in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. My parents were both undergraduates at the University of North Carolina, and I came along about that time.
Were they teaching there as well?
No. They were simply undergraduates, and they were married quite young, as sophomores, as a matter of fact.
And so, oh, you were born there, but you weren't raised.
I was born there. No, I was raised in a very small tobacco town called Henderson, which is sort of in the center of the state, close to the Virginia line, northern North Carolina. And I grew up there and left Henderson pretty much for good when I went to Exeter, which was in the when I was 13 or 14 in '69.
Well, you went from the deep south to New England, huh?
That was quite a
culture shock.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, though, it was a fairly smooth evolution for a lot of my friends who came from New England originally, or say the Connecticut area. For me, it was like a 4-year whaling voyage, in a way, because it was total immersion in a very unfamiliar element. And I think it, using those old criteria of in science, whether there's a smooth evolutionary progress to things, a uniformitarian concept, or a catastrophic, whether the world proceeds on those two bases. For me, Exeter was very catastrophic, and I think that by really shaking my self-image in a very profound way, it...
Are you talking about the culture, or are you talking about the rigorous academics?
Both to a degree, and also some of the circumstances that surrounded it. My parents were just getting divorced at that time also. So it was really as though the carpet was pulled out from under me. The South was gone at that point. And to some degree, I think I've been in an orbit away from the South for a long time, and maybe now I've reached the what would it be, the aphelion of that orbit, and have started going back toward the South.
You did go back to the South for college.
Right, I went back to Chapel Hill, but Chapel Hill's a little bit of a... it's an extraordinary circumstance in the South. It's a little sort of a charmed circle. And its relation, for instance, to the sort of South that I grew up, the small-town South that I grew up in, is... very tenuous.
What did you study in Chapel Hill?
I studied English and graduated in creative writing. But I was doing poetry. I was writing poetry exclusively at that point. And I only made the shift to fiction about 2 years after I graduated. I started writing some short stories, a couple of novella-length pieces. And that's when the idea of this book came to me, sort of on the basis of the pun alone, Dow, T-A-O, and D-O-W is in the Dow Jones Industrials. And I initially conceived it as a farce. I thought the idea of a Taoist monk who came to Wall Street using the I Ching as a method for forecasting stocks had some interesting comic possibilities. And then it was as the father search theme came into it that the book started to deepen.
There was little doubt then, as you went through your college years, what you wanted to do. You wanted to write in some form.
Right. I pretty much had decided that during my last year at Exeter. Of course, when you decide something like that at 17, you have no idea what you're getting yourself into. It's sort of like buying on credit, and then the bill comes in afterwards. But I really have never questioned it too much. It's been sort of a difficult road. I, for instance, the last The last year or so of writing this book, I was virtually insolvent and living in an old house on the coast of the Outer Banks, just trying to, you know, finish it, because it had turned out to be such a tremendous project, something like 1,400 manuscript pages, that I was anxious to finish it. But that was also the most gratifying time in a lot of ways, because it was after setting up a system of dominoes with all sorts of arabesques and whirligigs and so on, and then pushing them and watching them start to tumble. It really created its own energy, and I got swept up in it rather than myself being the supplier. I was the recipient of it at that point, and that was very exciting phase. Very exciting.
When did you graduate?
From Chapel Hill in 77.
And when did you start work on Confessions of a Taoist on Wall Street?
I started work on this book in January of 1980.
What did you do between 77 and 80?
I did several different things. I started out, I did a stint as a cabinet maker. After that, what I did most during that time was I worked as a commercial fisherman on scallop boats off of the Outer Banks, and also in Rhode Island, Point Judith, Rhode Island. I figured it was sort of obligatory that I go to sea at some point if I wanted to be an American writer.
But you were indeed writing during this period while you were laboring on the boats.
Absolutely. The money working on the commercial boats was actually quite good, and I was living close to subsistence level. I was living in my family's house, which is a large ramshackle summer cottage, unheated, but I'd put a wood stove and so on. And so it wasn't very expensive for me to live. So about Thanksgiving of the first year that I'd been down there, after working for about 6 months on the boats, I took that entire winter, and that was when I started to make some of those first experiments in fiction.
Were you? Did this include some beginning work on Confessions of a Taoist on Wall Street during that period?
Well, that was the time when the idea of the book originated. I was working on other things that were more directly, more facilely autobiographical, I would say. I have to say, this book is autobiographical in some sense, but it's reflected through so many mirrors and prisms that you'd have to know me very well to find me in it. And as a matter of fact, sometimes I have difficulty tracing the lines back to my own personal experience.
Do you indeed have a personal interest in Taoism, or are you a Taoist?
No, I'm not formally. Actually, the Chinese pronunciation, this is based on an old system of transliteration, but the T is pronounced as D, so it's Taoist.
It's pronounced Taoism? It's
pronounced Taoism. That's the pun is based on, on that partially, T-A-O and D-O-W. No, I'm not a Taoist in any formal sense, but Taoism really isn't a formal systematic philosophy anyway. But I became interested in it when I was in college. There was a lot of Eastern philosophy circulating in the halls of academe back at that point. And I looked at Buddhism. I looked at a couple of different schools of Buddhism, and Taoism, which is sort of a predecessor of Zen. It's a very simple philosophy that's attempting to reduce experience back to a condition of pure immediacy. That's about the closest I could come to it. And the cleanliness and the rigor of that particular search I found very appealing, and I always enjoyed going back and refreshing myself at some of the old Taoist texts. So I had that interest, and I also had a brother who was a stockbroker, but not in any sort of, well, not really in a conventional sense. When he was about 16 years old, he developed this absorbing passion with the stock market, in particular, the principle that makes it work. You know, how does it work? What is responsible for the fluctuations? Or is there any sort of guiding principle behind it? And I was infected by his enthusiasm for that, and the pun occurred sort of spontaneously. I happened to be reading Taoist literature at that time and also looking at the stock market, and suddenly one day, Tao and Tao. And the cosmic resonance of that pun, if I can put it that way, seemed to me very exciting. I was smitten with the idea of that because to take the TAO, the Chinese Tao, is supposed to be an all-embracing plasma that everything arises out of and everything comes back to. It's supposed to account for all reality. We tend, I think, when we think of the Eastern philosophies, we think of values of quiescence and self-transcendence. Well, if you take the most extreme antithetical instance of those values, for me, it's the DOW, it's Wall Street, it's the frenzy of the stock market, where the values are self-interest and aggressiveness. But if the TAO is valid, it has to account for the DOW at some point, and that was the search that I sent my main character, Sun Yi, in quest of. And
somehow it all comes together. I never would have thought that one could equate the two in the way that you've done it.
Well, it was an interesting experience attempting to do that, and also to just the way the plot spun itself out from that fairly abstract idea, and all the characters and everything. First of all, I wanted Sun Yi to have both Western and Oriental antecedents, so I made his father a combat pilot in China. First of all, I had to find out how could he have had an American father, and that led me into the Flying Tigers, and that was a lot of fun to research. And bit by bit, almost from that a priori basis, the plot and characters and the whole narrative structure of the novel evolved out of the seed of that pun.
Tell me about the writing process. You locked yourself into the house on the Outer Banks and began to work in the winter. Was it winter?
Right. Well, through most of the actual writing time of this book was about 3.5 years. And for most of that time, I kept very regular hours. I try to stay at the typewriter 8 hours a day or so, 5 days a week, take the weekends off. But toward the end, during the last 4-month phase, during which I wrote part three of the novel, which is about a third of the novel, maybe a little bit more than that, the two preceding parts one and parts two had taken about a year apiece to write, or a little over. This last part I wrote in 4 months' time. I was spending, occasionally I would spend as long as 36 hours straight at the typewriter. As I said, the energy sort of swept me up, and I was at its mercy. I would get up at odd hours. For instance, if I'd worked until, say, worked through the night and until the morning, I'd sleep until afternoon, and then start working in 5 or 6 in the afternoon again, and work through the night that way. So the day and night had sort of ceased to be differentiated in that during that time period.
Were you getting any input, any help, any advice during the writing of this book, knowing the speculative nature of writing fiction?
No. I had no tie-ins whatsoever to, I assume, like to publishers or agents.
Or a friend?
Oh, yeah. Occasionally I would show pieces to friends, but that was the extent of it. As a matter of fact, I had no idea how I would ultimately go about getting it published, and that was pretty much a trial and error type process. But luckily, a friend of mine who had been at Chapel Hill in the English department at the same time that I had been there worked as an assistant editor at Houghton Mifflin, he didn't actually do intercede for me, but he gave me the name of a young editor at Houghton Mifflin who'd published the last Literary Fellowship book. And he said, well, you know, this guy is interested in serious fiction. He's young. You know, he's willing to take risks. I suggest you send it to him. And it turned out that he was the one who expressed the most enthusiasm about the book, though a couple of other editors, one at Random House and one at Knopf, were also interested in it.
After the book was completed and it was submitted, did you work with the editor in making any revisions?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We spent, well, first I went with the editor and I worked on revising, and then it went through a very rigorous copy editing phase, which after it had been, after the copy editor had worked on it, I spent about another 2 months working on the manuscript after that.
According to the biographical data, it said that for 6 months you were wired, I believe is the way you phrased it. What was that all about?
That was just what I was describing earlier about the excitement of that last phase. It was a little bit scary, too. While it was still definitely a normal, controlled state of consciousness, I suspect that it was somewhat similar to a manic phase, you know, because there were times, for instance, I would try to go to sleep at night, and I would find my mind dieseling like an engine, you know, when you turn it off and it continues to shudder. And images, fragments of conversation would continue to just spill out, and I'd have to get up and write them down. That might go on for 2 hours or so. So it was like getting racked.
It took a while to come down. Are you living in Chapel Hill now?
No, I'm living in Winston-Salem.
Uh-huh. Are you living with your parents? You have your own home?
No, I have my own apartment there.
Why did you select Winston-Salem?
Well, I was in New York before I began the last section of the book, and money was becoming a problem. So I retreated to Winston-Salem, then went to the Outer Banks after that, where I could live, you know, for free. And so that was the initial reason for moving to Winston-Salem. I suspect now that I'll probably be back in New York within a year's time.
To work or to stay or what?
To stay.
Uh-huh. Well, you have the book in front of you. It's out at last, and you can hold it in your hand and turn the pages. Do you feel any sense of anticlimax?
The anticlimax started very early, even as early as the acceptance for publication and then the award and the fellowship. Those things were very gratifying, but in a short-term sense, it was like a little jolt of electricity. But after those 4 or 5 months of writing toward the end of the book, it was like a jolt of electricity from a wall outlet after having been to the core of the reactor, I suppose. And writers talk about, you know, the only thing that really matters in the end is the writing. Any kind of external validation is pretty specious, and it's true. I mean, you know, I'm sorry, it really is the truth. The only thing that that makes me want to continue to do this is the chance of building up that state of, well, tremendous energy and engagement and exhilaration that happened to me during the first phase of this book. It's I can't imagine anything more exciting or a profession that I would rather, you know, commit myself to.
What does the Houghton Mifflin Literary Fellowship Award do for you?
Well, there's certainly a lot of people on the list that have won it before that I respect, and it's nice to be in that company. Robert Penn Warren, Philip Roth won it for Goodbye Columbus, Dorothy Parker, Robert Stone, Willie Morris.
Not a good company to be in.
That's nice. For me personally, it means something to me to have the vote of confidence from the House because I respect the people there. Aside from that, it's pretty much a matter of getting the book a little bit more review attention than it would normally get, I suppose.
So it's really an honor more than any special prize or...
Well, yeah, there's a small monetary sum involved, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very significant.
What's next for David Payne?
I'm working on a book now that takes place on the Outer Banks, North Carolina, that it's basically about a young man who decides to go into a period of prolonged solitude, which makes it very autobiographical after all the things I've said. But he's decided that all society, social interaction, love itself is a form of expediency, a kind of local anesthesia that we apply to the wound of our radical aloneness. He's convinced that, on the basis of a series of tragedies in his own past, that ultimately we're alone, and that if there is any kind of redemption available to us, then we have to face that fact square, head on. So he decides to try and live this, and he goes into solitude on the island, which is another pun. I'm sort of fond of puns, as an I land. And the book is an alternation of passages that are sort of Waldenesque meditations on his daily life on the island, which are somewhat sterile in terms of human contact, totally sterile in terms of human contact, alternating with these extended conversations that he has with the dead. In other words, he relives each of the incidents that have led him to the, you know, to the brink of this precipice of deciding to, you know, to exile himself in this way. And he begins to experience a phenomenon known as catalepsy, which comes from a Greek root meaning possession. During the night in this house, he wakes up and for a short period of time is paralyzed, as though some heavy weight were lodged on his chest. And this is developed more and more during the course of the story. And so there's actually something that is a ghost of sorts, or it may be an angel. In any case, it's really the, sort of the lingering image of the human world that he's rejected. It's exerting a kind of gravity trying to pull him back into that world.
Is there a story contained in this opus?
Yeah, there is. Well, actually, it's in a pretty preliminary phase, but the story will be about his leaving, the things that have led him up to leaving, the story of his confrontation with this supernatural presence in the house and how that develops, and ultimately about his return to the, you know, to the human world with, after having discovered something that makes it possible for him to do that in good faith.
And David Payne, I can see you're a young man whose mind is always ticking, always thinking. Do you ever turn it off? Do you ever turn on the television set and watch a rerun of Tyler Moore?
Well, maybe not Mary Tyler Moore, but I'm sure, yeah, I just love to... I do turn it off. In terms of the work, though, I think that's really the obligation, is to, you know, for those hours at the typewriter, to keep it on as much as possible. And it takes a large expenditure of energy, but it's worth it to me.
Well, obviously, it's a major commitment. It was a major commitment, and devoting all of the hours, days, months, years, and sacrifices to do it. Trying to write is difficult because not very many people will pay you to do it. Nobody wants to take a chance, and so it's you who has to take the chance. And obviously, you've given it a shot, and you're willing to make that commitment. I certainly wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
I'll look forward to reading the new one. Is it going to be as big?
I don't think so. Hopefully not. Hopefully not.
Well,
on the other hand, I'm starting to tap into a vein of material now. This is almost disheartening if it weren't so positive in another way. That looks like it could be, you know, 10 years and 10 more volumes, but who knows?
Well, books have a tendency sometimes. I talk to a lot of writers, and the books have a tendency sometimes to write themselves. And sometimes they get away, and the characters get away, and the language gets away, and that's not necessarily bad, is it?
I don't think so. I think there are two different ways of looking at writing or approaching it. Some people seem to regard writing as a process of self-grooming. In other words, they're operating with some kind of ideal image of what they should be, what their mind should be, and they're rigorously pruning out all the uncontrollable or refractory impulses. I think Hemingway would be an example of that. He was disciplining it down to the nub. Other writers, and I would include myself in this category, are putting out as many polyps, or take another metaphor, putting out as many branches and leaves as possible to catch as much sunlight as they possibly can. The main thing, that for me, is that's what I want to do. I understand the other approach, but I disagree with it because it starts with an a priori idea of what you think you should be and what you should discover through your work and trying to conform to that ideal. My idea starts, I don't know what I'm supposed to be, what I'm doing here in the world. But I think the only way that I'll do it is by continually exploring as much as possible. And that means making a lot of experiments, some of which are not ultimately going to pan out, others of which may lead me to things that that other approach to writing I don't think would allow one to get to.
Well, you're thinking about things like that. Most people don't think about why they are here. They just are here, and some people make an absolute wreck of their lives. You walk out on the streets of New York and you see these homeless people, many of whom are mentally ill or just winos with bottles around them, and they're not thinking about anything, nothing. Their minds have atrophied or are completely gone. But I mean, these things are important for man to think about and to address, and I doubt if any of us will be able to produce a consensus, however, about why we're here.
Sure. Well, it's in a way, it's a privilege to be able to pursue that that kind of that level of self-exploration. And unfortunately, I think in some of the cases you mentioned, the basis of leisure is not there in the beginning to allow the search to continue. But in a way, it's that this is not a particularly flattering way of looking at it, but I think that's what society is paying good writers to do, is to spend that time in that particular mode of search to see what sort of light it might shed on some possibilities of being human that we might, that other people, because they're doing different jobs and keeping society running, don't have the time to devote the energy to.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a young writer named Alberto Alvarado Rios, who is very young. He's, I don't think he's 30 yet. He's teaching at Arizona State University at Tempe. And when he was in college, he took creative writing, and this seems simple. He took it because he thought it would be a Mickey Mouse course. Until the professor told him, all right, now I want you to write your own poem. Now, he'd been in college, and he had found that college was there to give him the answers. If he needed help with regard to the study of history, he could go and find it in a book or talk to a professor. If he needed to find the answers to a mathematical problem, he could do that. But he suddenly found that as a poet, he couldn't go ask somebody for the answers. He was the one who had to give the answers.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's what it boils down to. There's no help. You're utterly alone. And you don't want to embark on it if you don't have some natural predisposition to that kind of solitude. Otherwise, I would stay away from it as soon as possible.
David Payne, I've certainly enjoyed talking to you, and thank you very much for coming, and wish you the best. I'll be anxious to read your new book when it comes out, and I hope you enjoy your stay here in New York.
Thank you very much.